Good morning. Good morning. Amen. So this is our final Sunday in our series of creation. We've dealt with the atmosphere, with solar power, with the climate, and today we're dealing with the cosmos, which is admittedly a topic of significant size. And I'm told we have a congregational meeting to get to. So we can't go on forever. To make it worse, we're given four different texts, all of them that deserve attention in their own right. And notice in them, there's nothing about planets. There's nothing about celestial bodies. This is a Sunday on the cosmos, but we don't have anything that we traditionally associate with the cosmos in our scriptures. Instead, we get a pretty standard list of created things like we do in that passage from Proverbs. God created the mountains and the fields and the dust and the waters and the foundations of the deep. And then we get to these New Testament texts about Jesus being behind creation, being the head of the church, holding all creation together. And now at the end of this series, I have to confess to you something, and maybe it's just my experience, maybe it's not your own, but when I read about creation in the Bible, I have to be honest, I find it just a little bit boring. I don't find creation boring. I find the Genesis accounts fairly interesting, and I like nature. I grew up on nature documentaries. You remember those? Maybe they still have them. Maybe it's just because I was only allowed to watch PBS. Maybe that's why I watched so many of them. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I learned about lions on the savannah. It was odd. Nature only seemed to take place on the savannah. I don't understand. There was never any other nature to consider. But what made them so interesting is all the detail. That's what we like about documentaries. They fascinate us. The created world is fascinating. The created world that we get in the scriptures, and at least in today's scriptures, is simply a list of waters, mountains, hills, fields, dust, heavens, and clouds. There's no detail. How many of you have heard of the BBC documentary on planet Earth? Okay, if you haven't seen it, you need to watch it. Can we dim the lights? We're going to spend time watching a little bit of the trailer here. You can find a lot of these different trailers. This one didn't have any animals in it. The one I wanted to use had animals, but then I realized this morning it wasn't HD, so then I chose this one. It doesn't have any animals. But the thing about Planet Earth, I bought it, and I encourage everyone to watch it. It's really something of a spiritual experience. I mean, it's the reason they made HD televisions. It's really visually stunning. And when you get the set of discs, you open them up, and there's like five of them, and they say on each one what they are. There's the mountains, fresh waters, caves, deserts, ice worlds, great plains, jungles, shallow seas, seasonal forests, and deep oceans. And the plains one, for example, talks about grasslands all over the world. You have the savanna in Africa, and you have the plains in the great American West, and you have the tundra in northern Russia, and you have the grasslands of West Asia. I mean, these are grasslands we don't think of, and they all function in kind of the same way. Grass is an amazing plant. It can survive drought and die, and with water, come back to life, and it can survive being trampled by herds of animals, and it can serve as the primary food for all these animals. And watching this gives you kind of a new perspective on what the psalmist means when he writes, "And humans are like grass. They flower and fade." And if we were to look at some of the other trailers, we'd see that what is different kind of about the documentaries versus these lists in scriptures is there's a story in these documentaries. They spend 30 minutes looking at the snow leopard and the snow leopard hunting this like mountain antelope and then finally gets it. And they've actually done like character development with these two things. You're like happy for the snow leopard, but you're sad for the antelope. And stories of wet and dry, death and life, the effects of climate change on the environment. You can choose from any variety of storylines. But the one we get in the Bible seems to be just this one that God made the heavens and the earth, the fields, the mountains, and the clouds. It's less dynamic. It feels to me sometimes like I've opened up the disc set and there's no pictures and I didn't watch it and then I folded it back up. But there is a story here. It's just not as obvious. And it does relate to the cosmos, even though it has no planets or celestial bodies. See, the elements chosen in our passage in Proverbs are chosen for a very specific reason. With cosmos, you might expect us to look at NASA images or meteors or comets. But none of those existed in the Bible. They did literally exist out there, but they didn't exist in the minds of the biblical writers. In fact, in Greek, when the writers used the word hakosmos, where we get our word the cosmos, they weren't talking about galaxies because they didn't know about galaxies. When the Old Testament writers wrote the Psalms and Proverbs, they weren't doing astronomy. In fact, the first astronomy we have in the Bible, I think, I didn't exhaustively study this, but I think is when the Magi come to see Jesus in Bethlehem. And they are following a star, which we know to be fairly impossible. I remember when I was a kid, I really wondered. Like, so they're following the star, and the star gets over the stable, which was, of course, like a barn by the side of the road. And I wondered, if they walked past the stable and they looked up, would they still see the star? They'd have to turn behind them, right? Because it had settled above the stable, right? Doesn't make sense with our scientific worldview. We'll get back to those scientific questions in just a bit, but I want to look at our proverb and look at that list of things. Now, pardon. There's two things going on in this proverb. The first is this whole chapter is about wisdom. So when we read in verse 22, "The Lord brought me forth as the first of his works." This is wisdom talking. God created wisdom. Now, wisdom is a serious theme in Scripture that we rarely explore, and we're not going to explore it this morning either. It is fascinating. It helps us understand Jesus better. And if you're really interested in Chronicles, like some people are, it is like home base. But it would be unwise to try to tackle such a topic in 20 minutes. It would be unwise to talk about wisdom in 20 minutes. Okay, the second main thing going on in this proverb is all the creation stuff. We don't get the HD cameras and helicopters and moving music, but this is kind of like BBC in a nutshell. What is listed here, the things that were chosen for a very particular reason, because these were the outline of the cosmos for the ancient Hebrews. The watery depths, the mountains, the hills, the fields, the heavens, the deep, the sea, and the foundations of the earth. Keith's going to put a picture up here for you. I knew that one wouldn't work very well. Let's go to the next one. Okay. This was the cosmos of the Hebrews. So when it talks about the foundations of the earth, these are flat earthers. But they're not the flat earthers like Columbus was, where they thought they're going to fall off the other side of the ocean, because they didn't have an ocean. They lived in the Mediterranean. So the water's in the middle and the land's on the sides. So the mountains are these mountains that cannot be climbed on the edges of creation. The sea is in the middle. The watery depths surround everything. They're like in this water bubble. The creation in Genesis, where the Spirit was hovering over the face of the deep, I always thought of this as like water and air, and the, like land would rise out of it. No, this is 3D water. Everything's water. And God like tears it apart and creates this space in between where all the people can live. And below is Sheol. It's not what we think of as hell, but it is a place of the dead. And then the land is where people live, and then the firmament up above is where the gods live. They're still within this water bubble, but the stars and the moon were often thought to be, at various times, other gods, angels, Satan. So God lives up above. And all this water is all around, and at any time, that water could come crashing through. You could have rain coming down from the sky. You could have water rising up from the springs. That's what happened in the flood. God decided to wipe out creation, and the waters that God holds back, he let through. So when we read Proverbs and we read, "There were no oceans when I was given birth. There were no springs abounding with water. The mountains were not set in place when I was given birth, before he made the world or its fields or the dust of the earth. I was there when he set the heavens," this is the stars and the other gods, "in place. When he marked out the horizon of the face of the deep," that's the waters below the earth, "when he established the clouds and gave the sea its boundary." This is the backstory of the entire Old Testament. This is the image we have to have in mind when we read the stories like of Jacob, where Jacob falls asleep on a rock and he wakes up and he sees the hosts of heaven going up and down a ladder. And he says, "God is in this place." They're going from the firmament down. It's what we should have in mind when we read most of the Psalms. It's what we should have in mind when we read the book of Job. Now, the book of Job always kind of got me when I was little, not in a good way. I listened to this radio drama about the book of Job. And in the book of Job, there's this guy that suffers, and he's a really righteous guy. And all his children die, his wealth evaporates, his health seriously declines, and so he's angry. He wants to confront God with what's happened to him. So God comes in a whirlwind and essentially shames Job's questions into silence. I just want to read a bit of that. God asks, "Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or seen the storehouses of the hail, which I reserve for times of trouble, for the days of battle? What is the way to the place where the lightning is dispersed?" Now, I remember thinking when I was a kid, I was like, all right, he's got me on the first one. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? We weren't around. I was like, but really?
"Have you entered the storehouses of hail? I know where hail comes from."
See, I was kind of a smart aleck kid. "I know where lightning comes from. It's not up in some storehouse someplace, like this diagram would have us believe." This didn't shake my belief in God, but I did wonder, okay, if God was going to come today, what would he tell us to make us feel small and finite, to humble us, like he did Job? That was before I learned about black holes. This is the thing that considering the cosmos teaches us, whether we're the ancient Hebrews considering this cosmos or modern humans considering 5,000 and a million planets. We are so very, very, very nearsighted. Job claimed that events in his life contradicted the created order. And God showed Job how little he knew of the created order. You don't know where the hail is made. You don't know the foundations of the earth. But modern humans know where hail is made. And we know about volcanoes and tectonic plates. We have telescopes and complicated mathematics. But the cosmos still teaches us how finite we are. They teach us that what is true is beyond anything that we can actually imagine. Whatever we think about the cosmos today could be as seriously short-sighted as what the Hebrews thought of the cosmos in their day. If you're into physics, you may have heard of string theory that is currently in vogue in physics circles, positing multiple universes. These are phenomena we can't actually even observe and barely calculate. The theory of relativity that Einstein came up with, which has been the bedrock of astronomical observation, describes the working of space-time and gravity, has recently been challenged by quantum theorists arguing that the theory has left us with the assumption that the speed of light is constant, which is how we calculate everything out there in the cosmos. It's saying that that is an incorrect conclusion. So the reigning theory of astrophysics is now in question, or potentially partially false. This isn't to reprimand science in any way. Simply to say that our own experience, not just our spiritual texts, remind us that human reason is limited. It's finite. It's what it means to be human. It's what the psalmist was saying when he said humans are like grass. They're here today and gone tomorrow. They flower and fade. We are humans and God is God. The creation is beyond our comprehension because the Creator is beyond our comprehension. And this God we worship, for all we know, is similarly unknown. Let's take the next picture. That was a medieval picture. Obviously, people are beginning to think in different ways about God and creation. The next one is called the Flammarion engraving. It's by an unknown artist. It appeared in a French book on meteorology by Camille Flammarion. And you can see, this is kind of like the Hebrew model right here, or the Truman Show. And the Enlightenment has stuck the guy's head out of his old view of the cosmos, and all these mechanical gears and everything is talking about mathematics and the modern scientific revolution. He's seen the world is much bigger and much different than he thought. Interestingly, we always talk about human knowledge as progress, how we're learning more, how things are changing. Look how much smarter he is now that he's stuck his head out. We never think of human progress looking the other way at how kind of dumb we were before. And in science, we don't talk near enough about how great God might be. So what am I saying with all of this? I want us to consider that even though our perspectives keep changing, which tells us how limited our knowledge is, there is something actually quite profound about the Hebrew cosmos. And it can be just as profound in our own model of the universe. This takes us to our second passage in Psalms, and don't worry, we're not going through all four passages. In that passage, we hear about Leviathan. In talking about the sea, this is where Leviathan frolics, it says. Now, what is Leviathan? This Leviathan is this ancient cosmic serpent of chaos. If you want to have a really fun afternoon, go Google Leviathan and look at Google Images. This is fundamentalist Christianity's like playground, let me tell you. You see Leviathans eating, like that actually existed, eating giant squids like minnows. It's really something else. Interestingly enough, research for this sermon also took me to the Christian Flat Earth Society, which is a similarly interesting website. But Leviathan's more interesting. Whether the Leviathan actually existed, whether it was a dinosaur, the Loch Ness Monster, or simply whales in the Mediterranean, that's not the point. Keith, let's not turn to that next video. The point is that the Hebrews took the chaos of life, because life is hard. There's a lot of difficulty in it, and they personified it or characterized it in this sea creature. Famine, war, abuse, PTSD, natural disasters, broken relationships. All of that goes into this big water monster that frolics in the sea at the center of that Hebrew cosmological map. And also, theoretically, in the water that surrounds the earth. Those waters that can come crashing down at any time. In the Hebrew Bible, God is the one who puts boundaries on chaos. God is the one who separates the waters and keeps them held out there and all the monsters that are in them. That's who God is. That is God's primary identity in much of the Old Testament. God keeps chaos in check. Now, what we think of as in check and what God thinks of as in check could be as different as what we think the cosmos are and what the cosmos really are. But what the Hebrews knew about God is as profound today as it was then. God is the God of the cosmos. God created them. And it's God's job to keep chaos from taking over. In Job, God asks Job, "Can you pull in Leviathan with a fish hook? Or tie down its tongue with a rope? Can you put a cord through its nose or pierce its jaw?" Job is silenced. When Jesus calmed the storm on the Sea of Galilee, the ancient home of Leviathan, the serpent, the disciples were also silenced. Confronted with the chaos of our own lives and how God sometimes settles them, we are silent. But then there's the chaos that God doesn't settle. God has set boundaries on the chaos in life. He said, "Here and no further." I wish he had chosen a different here. Chaos by its nature never looks bound. It never looks limited. It never looks like it's being controlled. War never looks like it has boundaries. Neither does famine. Neither does climate change. Do we really think that God has set a limit here and no further? Does God still hold the waters at bay? Where are the boundaries to addiction, to poverty? These are things that result in death. It is hard to hold what the Bible tells us alongside what we experience. And maybe you're here this morning with your own chaos. But it doesn't seem that there's limits. And maybe you can't believe this morning. But that's why you came here. Because the church, of which Jesus is the head, says Colossians, this creation that Jesus is behind, the church is the place that remembers what is so hard to remember in everyday life. The church is sometimes the place that believes for you when you can't find the strength to believe for yourself. The church is the place where we hear this story of God's cosmos, where God pulls Leviathan around by a hook in his nose. If this is too great to understand, then it takes us back to the first lesson of the sermon, that we are finite and there is much that we do not know.